welcome into the latest episode of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. Today is Monday, August 2nd. This week, we review an article published in the July issue of the journal Oncology, and it's titled Level of Scientific Evidence Underlying the National Comprehensive Cancer Network Clinical Practice Guidelines for Hematologic Malignancies. I spoke with Dr. Thage Punacha, a staff physician and hospitalist in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical Centers and one of the corresponding authors for this research from him and his colleagues. We focused on the scientific evidence behind the NCCN guidelines for heme malignancies, how each category corresponds with different levels of evidence, and their findings overall from this study. Punacha shared exactly what this means and why this research was so top of mind for this group of authors. So, Dr. Punacha, thank you so much for taking some time to hop on the podcast and speak with me about your work. Just to start, why was this topic, you know, so top of mind for you and your colleagues? And what I'm referencing is the article in the journal titled Level of Scientific Evidence Underlying the National Comprehensive Cancer Network Clinical Practice Guidelines for Heme Malignancies. You know, why was that so top of mind, and really what pushed you to pursue the research in this area?
Sure. This work largely began sometime in 2009, particularly when most medical teams relied on guidelines. So when people had a question or when they needed answers, they just went to the guidelines. But I don't think at that time we went and looked into the guidelines to see what is the level of evidence? What evidence is available to say this is the standard of care? Although we know that guidelines are developed by learned people, professionals, and it goes through multiple vetting processes before they come out and before they are being accepted. So originally, we did a study for about 10 common cancers in the US and looked into the NCCN guidelines for these 10 cancers to see what the level of evidence was. That is when it started. And at the same time in 2011, my co-author, Dr. Goh, did a similar one for hematological malignancies. And the answers and the results were fairly similar. They were sort of low level of evidence, but with uniform expert opinion and consensus. And along those lines, we kind of redid a study in 2020 to see if things have changed from 2011 to 2020. Because in 2011, when we did the study and when we published it, we did offer some recommendations to see how this could change, how we could do a better job of trying to work on areas that needed more work to be done. And we just sort of left it that way, and we didn't go back to explore if change had taken place. And that's why we redid the study in 2020 to sort of see if there has been any change. So that was sort of the background for why we did this study. Yeah.
And so before we get into kind of the nuts and bolts of the research, let's take care of a little bit of housekeeping. You know, talk to me a little bit about what these clinical guidelines are for heme malignancies. Could you give a little background on them for our listeners?
Coming back to the question. So guidelines are a sort of a constructive response to the reality that practicing physicians require assistance to apply and assimilate the exponentially expanding and often a contradictory body of medical knowledge. The NCCN guidelines is actually a nonprofit alliance of 31 leading US cancer centers designated as National Cancer Institutes. The organization has engaged in the development of clinical practice guidelines for the past many years, utilizing the best contemporary evidence and expert consensus. And currently, there are about 73 NCCN guidelines for different forms of cancer that cover cancer detection, cancer prevention, risk reduction, workup, diagnosis, treatment, and supportive care. We did the study specifically on the heme malignancies, particularly the cancers that we included for hematological malignancies include acute myeloid leukemia, multiple myeloma, Hodgkin's lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, mantle cell lymphoma, marginal zones lymphoma, and AIDS-related B-cell lymphoma and Burkitt's lymphoma. These are the 10 hematological malignancies we studied. And these are the hematological malignancies by virtue of their incidence in the U.S.
Perfect. And then in the main bulk of the research as well, you focus on these categories of evidence and consensus that are really the focal points of the paper. So could you just explain what they are and really what defines each category that you discuss?
Sure. The NCCN definitions for various categories and consensus are: category one is high level of evidence with uniform NCCN consensus that the intervention is appropriate. Category 2A is lower level of evidence, but with uniform NCCN consensus that the intervention is appropriate. Category 2B is lower level of evidence with the uniform NCCN consensus that the intervention is appropriate, but with no major disagreement. Category 3 is any level of evidence, but with major disagreement that the intervention is appropriate.
Great. And so looking at the review, you know, what methods did you use to review the level of evidence for these recommendations? And how did this compare to maybe other research that focuses on this area in this field, you know?
So we reviewed the number of recommendations included in the clinical practice guidelines for each malignancy and the level of evidence associated with each recommendation. We actually abstracted the recommendations after carefully reviewing the content within each guideline document and the displayed text within the graphical algorithms that come up in the NCCN guidelines. And we enumerated the evidence and consensus categories for each of the guidelines according to the four major areas of recommendation, that is staging, initial treatment, salvage treatment, and surveillance. And with regards to the follow-up question, similar studies have been done. Like I said, we already did a study in 2010 with regards to the 10 most common cancers in the US. We're using the NCCN guidelines. Right. Likewise, I've done a study even on the American College of Chest Physician guidelines for the guidelines that are available for chest medicine. And likewise, there are guidelines, there are studies related to the guidelines of cardiology as well as nephrology. And all of these guidelines sort of talk about the same thing, that the level of evidence that is out there is sort of fairly lower level. There's very few high level or category one level of evidence, but most of the evidence that informs the clinical practice guidelines for all these branches of medicine are more sort of low level of evidence, but with expert opinion.
So off of that, you know, you mentioned that's what most of the studies will find. With the over 1,300 recommendations you and your colleagues reviewed, did you find a similar kind of result there, or was there something different that stood out?
Yes, in what we studied, about 1,353 recommendations, 5% was category one, 91% was category 2A, 3% category 2B, and 1% category 3 evidence.
And so put that into perspective for me. What does that mean for people who would read this paper? You know, really, how is that significant and compared to the other things that other research may have found in this area?
So, well, what it actually says is that while guidelines are there to be followed, and that is the only body of comprehensive knowledge that we have to treat cancers, one must be aware that these guidelines are, majority of these guidelines are lower level of evidence, but with expert opinion. So it does not mean that you have to follow the guidelines the way they are put out in the guideline, clinical practice guidelines document itself. And there may be some subtleties, there may be some changes within the way the patient presents or the comorbidities of the patient that you may have to deviate. And you don't have to go exactly by these guidelines, but guidelines will serve as a pathway for you to pursue care for the patient and sort of help you while you plan treatment, but it may not be set on stone that you have to follow a certain pathway of guideline, because it was derived through a consensus and expert opinion. If the patient fits into the criteria, then yes, one could go ahead and pursue that. But if there are differences in the way the patient presents, then your clinical experience will count in what you choose to provide care for the patient.
Right, right. And so kind of looking ahead, do you and your colleagues have anything planned to kind of build off of this research? And if not, you know, what would you recommend researchers in this area kind of focus on that you weren't able to address in your work?
Sure. So, we do agree that it is not NCCN's responsibility to come up with high level of evidence. NCCN has done a great job in assimilating the best available evidence that is out there. And they've tried their best to involve experts from all around the world to come up with this document through significant review and agreement before the guidelines come up. But what we've seen is, of course, there hasn't been much change in terms of whether the quality or the level of evidence has changed over the last 10 years. So one of the things that we thought and reviewed was that the current NCCN guidelines really does not differentiate between low level of evidence and no evidence at all. This distinction becomes extremely important to outline the areas of unmet need. And therefore, funding and probably funding and importance could be sort of light could be thrown at these areas where there is no much evidence, and therefore these areas should be prioritized where further research is critical. And that is what we kind of decided in terms of what our conclusion should be based off the study.
Certainly. And so lastly, to kind of sum things up, is there anything that I haven't asked about or that we haven't touched on regarding your work that you think is important to kind of emphasize in this space?
No, what I do acknowledge is that, again, the NCCN actually acknowledges that the quality of existing evidence in cancer research is highly variable. And in a recent study, only 16% of the NCCN recommendations are based on the results of randomized phase 3 trials. But that is to show that there is only that much that is available there. So we have to be fairly innovative in our ways to approach the unmet need. And one of the ways to perceive this is do comparative effectiveness research and sort of see if there are 3 or 4 treatment options for the same cancer, which there is, then perhaps doing a comparative effectiveness research in determining which one is better off before, and therefore have clinicians sort of hone in on the one that has the best evidence based on this research.
Right. Well, Dr. Punaja, this was a great conversation. Thank you so much for lending your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review to tell us what you want to hear more about moving forward. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again next time.